from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about William Mumler. He was a photographer in the 1800s who took portraits of people with ghosts in them. These photos had faint images of spirits. These were people, sometimes children, sitting or floating in the air. And Mumler made a very good living at this until he was arrested as a fraud. The historian Peter Manceau tells Mumler's story in a new book. We'll talk about it after this.
Is something missing from your morning breakfast or evening dinner prep? How about NPR's critically acclaimed sound-rich stories alongside KUER's in-depth local news? Now with smart speakers, listening just became a whole lot easier. Tell Alexa or your Google Home to play NPR, and they'll take you right to KUER's live stream. Unlock the world of public radio with just your voice by telling Alexa or Google to play NPR, and never get stuck in the driveway again.
This is Radio Westenberg Fabrizio. William Mumler was making a very good living selling spirit photographs in the 1800s. And the way it worked is that you would go into a studio and you would sit for a portrait. And when the image was developed, there would usually be some ghostly spirit there with you in the frame. Maybe a small child sitting next to you, or an elderly figure floating above you, or maybe there would be more than one of these ghosts. Probably the most famous spirit photo is with Mary Todd Lincoln. This was taken several years after President Lincoln had been killed. It's actually the last photograph taken of her by William Mumler. Go Google it, and you'll see. There she is, sitting in this cloak, her arms folded, and sure enough, there is the faint image of Abraham Lincoln standing behind her with his hands on her shoulders. William Mumler was arrested and charged with fraud in 1868. It's the story told by the historian Peter Manceau in his latest book. And it's not just about Mumler's trial, but it's about the spiritualist movement that took hold in the country during that time, and why it was that people wanted to believe there was some way to communicate with the dead. The book is called The Apparitionists. Peter Manceau is a writer and historian, curator of American religious history at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. He joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington, and a few years ago, he talks about how he had written a book about religious life in the U.S., but he says he really missed the movement of spiritualism. That's what led him to this story.
In 2015, I published a book called One Nation Under Gods, which tells the story of religious diversity in America from the very beginning, how for 500 years, America has been a place where all these different interesting, competing and conflicting religious ideas have been colliding with each other. And so I published that book, and I looked back over what I had done, and I realized there was a big hole in this, what I hoped was a complete telling of American history in the late 19th century. And also there was a hole in dealing with this phenomenon of spiritualism. Spiritualism today, we remember, if we remember it at all, as a phenomenon of hucksters holding seances, tapping on tables, and mainly perpetrating a fraud on the gullible. But at the time, beginning in the middle of the 19th century and really going for decades, rising and falling with events happening in the nation, spiritualism was a major cultural force. For a time, it was the fastest growing religious movement in America. There were more spiritualists in the late 19th century than there were Catholics or Jews, for example. And so I was interested in this question of how a tradition that was so popular, that was such a part of the fabric of American belief, can be mostly forgotten, can be reduced to something only on the fringes of society. And so I wanted to tell that story. I wanted to rewrite spiritualism back into American history. And to do so, I needed to find the right figure, the right spiritualist with a story to tell. And for me, that was William Mumler, the spirit photographer.
When did you find him?
A lot of my research occurs in newspaper archives, and I just enjoy reading the newspapers of the 19th century. They're a fascinating view into American history, to be able to experience history as it was lived by those at the time, to know the stories that enthralled them and to absorb the language through which those stories were told. I was just reading a lot of 19th century newspapers deep in archives. And in the 1860s, I came across the story of this fellow, William Mumler, who first makes a name for himself in Boston as someone who is quite surprised by his ability to take photographs of ghosts.
Right. Yeah. What a lead that is. But what's the question here at the heart of it all? Because it seems like you have to take into context what was happening. I mean, the Civil War seems really crucial. And the fact that people for the first time maybe were dealing with a kind of collective grief and a sense of what to do about so many dead. And it seems like that's a critical part of understanding at least this part of your story?
That's certainly part of it. There is grief like the nation has never seen before. 750,000 to 1,000,000 people killed. Everyone is personally touched by it. And there is this hunger to communicate, to reverse this sense of loss that so many people have experienced. And spiritualism, which had been waning, returns. It becomes as popular or more so than it ever had been before. So spiritualism is certainly tapping into this moment of national grief.
You mentioned early in the book the fact that, you know, these days people have a camera with them pretty much everywhere they go, billions of photographs taken every day. And so I guess it must take a bit of extra effort for you to give this sense to readers, the sheer novelty of a photograph in another time. I mean, they're ubiquitous, of course, now, but at a certain time, at this time that you write about, they were remarkable and novel.
That's what I really wanted to recreate in telling the story, which is a thoroughly researched, completely non-fictional account of the life and crimes of William Mumler. But I wanted to recreate it down to the detail, including the emotional detail, of just the miracle that photography must have seemed at the time. The ability suddenly, as if overnight, to preserve the face of a lost loved one. Before photographs began to be used to capture human faces, only those with the means to hire a portrait painter would have the resources to remember the faces of their grandparents, let's say. For everyone else who could not afford to have a portrait painting commissioned, they began to lose the features of their loved ones as soon as they closed their coffin lids. Photography allowed people to hold on to those faces in a way never before imaginable. And as a result, this new technology, photography, became entwined in this moment around the Civil War with the way in which Americans were thinking about death and about grieving and about what it means to remember.
Early on in the book, you say that the stories here, as you say, the life and crimes of Mumler, form this larger account of how, and I want to put it how you do in the book, how the possibility of manipulating these images overtook all other means of understanding the past. What do you mean by that?
Well, suddenly we had these plates of glass at first and then images transferred to paper that are perceived to be objective tellings, objective capturings of a moment in time. They're perceived to be God's pen, they were called at the time. This idea that this is not a work of human artifice or craft, but it is simply the moment as it was, recorded forever. And of course, we now, because photography is so ubiquitous, we're a bit more sophisticated about it. We know that every photograph is a work of artifice. We can frame images, we can edit them, we can Photoshop them and make them appear to be whatever we want them to be. But when photography was new, when it was this miracle, it seemed to everyone who beheld it simply a moment frozen in time. And as a result, it seemed to be the perfect medium for recording history, as well as those faces of lost loved ones. It seemed unalterable. It seemed not created by human hands, but simply what we all hope for, just for a moment that never passes.
I like how there's an author's note at the front where you say that you, I like this, you say, I make no claims for the reality of the apparitions, that you let the men and women who believed in those things speak for themselves. What about that? How strong was the belief in ghosts and apparitions for the time? Because I think that's another thing that we lose track of in a modern society, that people were seeing these specters, even though people do believe that kind of thing still today, I guess, but they were seeing this stuff and it seemed real. It was real to people.
Yeah. Well, that was the part that really compelled me about the story. As mentioned, I'm the curator of American religious history at the Smithsonian. I'm someone who writes about religion generally. And so while there's one way to approach a story of a character like William Mumler and simply to tell it as, here is this huckster who's somehow pulling something over on everyone, I was much more interested in the thousands of people who believed in him. Right. And there truly were thousands who believed. And the reasons for that belief are complicated. It's in part based on this grief that we've spoken about, that everyone was in mourning. They were desperate to have an enduring vision of people they had lost. They were also somewhat bewitched by this new technology of photography, this possibility of freezing moments in time. And all of this contributed to this sense of belief in the invisible, this idea that there were forces all around us that technology was going to allow us to interact with. And that's a really interesting thing about spiritualism. We think of it today as being some variety of superstition, and we tend to think of technology as being an enemy of superstition. Yeah. And yet at the time, and I would argue still today, our technologies contribute to our beliefs in the invisible very often. And that's really what was at the heart of the Mumler phenomenon.
I couldn't tell. It's interesting. And we'll dig into the trial here in a moment, but I couldn't tell when John Townsend, Mumler's defense attorney, says that Mumler had never pretended to know the process, the power of this thing, how these things were produced, and that he said that this is an actual technology that might actually be able to capture the dead. I couldn't tell if he actually believed that, if he was just... And there are moments when I can't honestly tell whether Mumler in some weird way was more than a huckster and did believe this in some strange way, too. I mean, it seems like there's a give and take here, at least in the way I'm reading it, that I find really interesting.
Yes, and that's a great mystery about Mumler. He certainly presents himself as someone who was just overwhelmed by the circumstances in which he found himself. He only tried to take a regular photograph, and when he developed it, there was a ghost staring back at him. Yep. He didn't know what to do with this information, and so had to be convinced that what it seemed to be was what he had done. And this becomes a real power of how he presents himself, in fact. He presents himself as somewhat of a bungler, someone who could never pull this off if he was trying to fool everyone. Mm-hmm. And as a result, there's a certain innocence to him that comes through in the story. Mm-hmm. And so seen cynically, this is all part of his act, and it's very skillfully played. But seen another way, that he's caught up in these forces as well, that he can't explain just as well as everyone else who believes in him can't explain. They're all caught in the mystery.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about his life before he takes this remarkable photo. Describe him as agreeable and careful, responsible, portly guy, seemed like a likable fellow. He was an engraver, made a decent living. At least early on.
He did. He was a silver engraver, worked for a very respectable firm in Boston, made quite a good living, more than most tradesmen of his day, and was also taken up, as many people were, with this new fad of photography. It was becoming at that point not only something that professionals were pursuing, and professionals were proliferating in every city and town in the country, but also something that hobbyists could begin to learn for themselves. And so down the street from his engraving shop, there was a photography studio where he began to teach himself how to take photographs. And it was in the course of this that he took a self-portrait. And when he developed the portrait, he was quite surprised by what he saw.
Yeah. Before we get to that moment, I do want to ask about the clues that we may have seen in his early life that, at least that I saw. That for a time, for example, he peddled, and later in his life he did this, a kind of, I don't know, it was the snake oil sort of remedy or elixir, and did pretty well at it. And this was at the time when he was kind of searching for a It seems like he was searching for a kind of a purpose in his life. He had been in this malaise, and he was looking for something for his life.
Yes, it does seem that he had been in what he described as a spiritual malaise, and he felt this manifested in his body. In fact, he suffered from what he considered to be dyspepsia, which, according to his telling and other newspaper accounts and the types of products that were advertised at the time, was a very common affliction. Dyspepsia was afflicting most of Boston, if you judge from the advertisements.
Right.
So Mumler, who was a lifelong chemical tinkerer, in part because he grew up in a family of confectioners, his mother was known for her sweets. He knew how to work in the kitchen, and so he managed to mix together what he called his German remedy, something that was to be ingested and would help with your dyspepsia and help you live a better life. He attached a rather fantastical legendary story to it about its origins as an ancient German cure that was brought to the United States, and he sold it and did fairly well with it, as you say.
Yeah. Did you see that as a clue for his propensity maybe to stretch the truth a bit and try to make money off of gullible people?
There is that, but there's also that he's a real entrepreneur.
Yeah,
he was someone who had a steady job and, as far as we can tell, made a sufficient living for all his needs. And yet he wanted something more, both spiritually and materially. He wanted to build something. So he set up shop on his own and was able to sell this German remedy.
That's Peter Menso. His book is The Apparitionists, a tale of phantoms, fraud, photography, and the man who captured Lincoln's ghost. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER's new project, The Hive Mind, puts you right in the newsroom with our reporters. Here's how it works. Look under the News and Programs tab at KUER.org, click on The Hive Mind, and you'll see what one of our reporters is working on. Maybe it's affordable housing or national parks fees. It changes. You tell us what you want to know, vote on other listeners' questions, and we'll try to figure it out. It's like this. The news is for you, and you should have some say in how we make it. Join The Hive Mind at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the story of William Mumler. He was a photographer in the 1800s who took portraits of people with ghosts in them. Our guest is the writer and historian Peter Manso. He has a book. It's called The Apparitionists, a tale of phantoms, fraud, photography, and the man who captured Lincoln's ghost. Let's talk about his wife. Woman becomes his wife, Hannah, when they meet, and she has this kind of magnetism. She was, this is fascinating, she was a weaver of the hair of the dead. She braided the hair of people who had died, and this has this connection. She becomes this kind of medium. Talk a little bit about Hannah, because she's another great character here.
Sure, and that's one of the things that I think makes Mumler so likable. It's very endearing how he simply falls for this woman, Hannah Green Stewart. He is, as I've been able to glean the story, he is simply walking by her photography studio one day and catches sight of her through the large plate glass windows that they have to let in all the natural light necessary for photography. Hannah Green Stewart was a faith healer, a medium, so someone who claimed to be able to speak to the dead, and to have the dead speak through her. And she also was someone who helped people with their own grieving processes. And one way she did that was to take the hair of the deceased and to make keepsake bracelets and necklaces and lockets from the hair of your dead loved one so that you could always have some of that with you. And this was a fairly common practice at the time. The one innovation that people like herself began to bring to it in the 1850s and 60s is that you could have a locket or a bracelet or a necklace made of human hair that you could then attach a small photograph to, a photograph of the deceased person. So you would have both material from their actual body and the image of their face, which, as we've mentioned, would be gone from your memory otherwise.
Yeah.
So she was working in this milieu of people grieving, people coming to her for some kind of solace, and Mumler begins to be drawn into this world through her.
He's almost a skeptic, I think, at the time. I mean, he has to be convinced. He doesn't really believe you can communicate with the dead, not in that early moment. But as he's taken in by Hannah, and I don't mean fooled by her, but as he's drawn to her and he falls in love with her.
He speaks directly to her animal magnetism.
Yeah. Yeah.
This force that was believed in at the time, that was this invisible energy that moved through all living bodies.
Right.
He felt that Anna had more magnetism than anyone he had ever met. And to watch her cure people was to see that if she touched them, they would convulse with the electricity rushing through her body. Mm-hmm. So she was apparently a very persuasive person. And she was able to convince Mumler of some of these spiritual realities that up until that point, he did not believe in at all. He
yeah.
considered himself to be a mocker of spiritualists. He thought of himself as someone who was a skeptic, who was not taken in by this faddish new spirituality that was then gaining hold in Boston.
So this brings us back to this story. As you say, he was a dabbler in photography. It seems like it was kind of, for the time, it was like ham radio. You know, some people did it, and they played around with it, and they really took to it. And Mumler had taken to this new vocation of photography, and he takes this photo. He's playing around, I guess, and he takes this photo of himself just as kind of practice. And as you said before, there is sitting in a chair there in this image a woman, kind of a faintly figure of a girl.
Yes.
Now, tell this story, because he does not know what to make of it. It's pretty weird.
Well, at the time, we need to remember that photography was not point-and-shoot approach to cameras and taking pictures. It was an elaborate process.
Yeah.
And so in order to take a self-portrait, as Mumler was trying to do at the time, you need to arrange your camera. You need to put a glass plate in the back of the camera coated with a chemical mixture of silver. And then you need to arrange it in a room full of natural light. And after you remove a cloth to expose the glass plate, you need to stand very still for, at this time in photographic history, for about 25 seconds. Mm-hmm. So Mumler goes through all these steps that he's still in the process of learning. He stands still before the camera. But then when he takes a few steps behind the camera, removes the plate, and goes to the dark room, as he tells the story, that's when things start to get a little weird, because
yeah.
though he had been quite alone in the photography studio, standing next to a chair, when he develops the image, he sees that in that chair is a girl who seems to be made of light.
Right.
She's a young girl, maybe in her teens, someone who is there and not there at the same time.
Right.
He wonders if he must have made a mistake, if perhaps the glass plate that he used had been used for a picture previously and had not been washed properly. But as he studies the image, he sees that he can see through the girl to the chair in such a way that that is probably not the case. He doesn't know what to make of this, mm-hmm. and he begins to show it to people who he thinks might be able to explain it to him.
Yeah. At what point does he start to think that, hey, this is a long-lost cousin of mine who had died some 12 years before?
Well, at first, as I said, he is a mocker of
yeah.
the very notion of that. And
yeah.
he presents it to a spiritualist who he's friendly with, and he does it as a joke. And this spiritualist suggests that maybe he has discovered something more than just a joke. But it's not until Hannah sees it, and Hannah, knowing something of his family history is able to persuade him that, in fact, this is a cousin of his who had died many years before, and here she was visiting him again. And it's at that point, through Hannah's powers of persuasion, that he begins to believe.
Seems like there's a turning point at this part of the story. Mumler's not a believer at that time. And yet the story catches on. It makes headlines, at first without his consent. And he's kind of embarrassed about all of this. People are hearing about this story of this image and this man. And it seems like he has to pick sides almost.
Now, word gets out about the photograph and in two newspapers, one a spiritualist newspaper in Boston and then in New York. And he is mortified to see not only that his full name is listed as the person who has taken this mysterious photograph, but so is the address of Hannah Green Stewart's photo studio. So he is horrified that this woman, who he has at this point been courting, that she could receive some ill fame for this. So he rushes to the photo studio to explain to her what has happened. And when he gets there, the photography studio salon is crowded with spiritualists who are all there eager to see the photograph. Yeah. And that seems to be the real turning point, when Hannah is not angry with him, but rather is so excited to see him and welcomes him into this spiritualist throng. That seems to be one of the turning points. But on the practical side, he has also discovered in this woman, Hannah Stewart, a co-conspirator, but what I really mean is a fellow traveler of sorts, someone who shares a lot in common with him, not necessarily in terms of belief at this point, but they are both of this entrepreneurial spirit. They're both trying to create something new in the world. And I think that their desire to do that feeds off each other, as well as Mumler being urged on by this magnetism that Hannah has. And they decide at that point to reproduce the photograph, to sell it. Mm-hmm. And as that takes off, they realize they might have a business on their hands.
Let's back up just a bit, the beginnings of this spiritualist movement. And it's interesting, we can actually set a fairly clear date on when this begins in the United States. It's the spring, you write, of 1848. There's kind of a creation myth here. And it involves these sisters, two in particular at first, Kate and Margaret Fox. Tell this story, if you will, because this is one of those moments that really takes off and begins this movement.
So Kate and Margaret Fox are teenage sisters living in their family's home in the village of Hydesville, which is outside of Rochester, New York. And apparently, to pass the time, one weekend, they begin to make taps and knocking sounds around their house, and they are able to persuade their parents that these taps and knocks are coming from inside the walls and under the floors, and they don't know where they're coming from. Their parents believe this and begin to investigate, and they cannot find any source for these sounds. And gradually, the sisters begin to associate a story with the sounds. They begin to say that as they listen to the sounds, they are communicating to them that they're being made by the spirit of a man who had been killed in that house, a peddler who stopped by that house long before the family lived there and was murdered. And he has now found this way of communicating with the living. Perhaps to figure out if her sisters are telling the truth, their third sister returns to investigate, and the three of them together begin to hear these sounds. Mm-hmm. And the parents begin to talk about the strange goings-on at their house in Hydesville, and crowds begin to come. Yeah. First dozens, then hundreds, and then the crowds are so vast that no one can get in the house. The Fox sisters at that point take it on the road. Yeah. So people are so interested in the way these sisters are able to communicate with the dead that they want to see it performed. They begin to present this in theaters around the country, and this movement around them springs up, spiritualism, this idea that the dead not only are all around us, but want to communicate. They want to be heard. And it's said at this time that this is a new moment of divine revelation, that the gates between this world and a place called Summerland, the world to come, have opened, and this is a new moment in human history. And it all begins with these sisters in this little farmhouse in upstate New York.
As it catches on, you mentioned one quote that where someone said spiritualism had become the new church. And I wonder, is that true in some way? Was spiritualism, this kind of performative part of it, the idea of somehow communicating in these seances and other things, had that come to displace in some way actual conventional American religion?
Well, this is a moment in American religious history when there are enormous number of new religious movements taking off, many of them in that same general vicinity in upstate New York.
Yeah.
And so the sheer number of different communities competing for new believers indicates that, yes, there was some real dissatisfaction with the religious status quo. Americans at this point were trying and looking for something new. This is all more broadly part of a moment known as the Second Great Awakening,
right,
which is generally remembered as a moment of dramatic change within Christian denominations, but it also extends far beyond to various utopian communities and other movements that are springing up here and there. Some survive and some don't.
Right.
They are constantly colliding and transforming each other. And
well, speaking from Utah, this is where Mormonism, of course, catches hold, is in upstate New York.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And it's exactly part of this milieu, which at the time had been known as the burned over district,
right,
because it was said that there was not a soul in all of New York that had not been touched by divine fire. And so this is all growing out of this movement, this moment in American history when Americans, a generation after the American Revolution, are wondering, who are we as a people? Who are we spiritually? What might we be in this new land? And it unfolds over decades that follow. And the Mormon movement grows out of that, and spiritualism does as well. And so if you wanted to draw a family tree of all these movements, it would be terrifically complex, but they would all have many of their roots there in upstate New York.
You write this in the book. You write that, like a water glass filled from a barrel, spiritualism was a hokey parlor trick turned into the receptacle for the most intense collective grief the nation had ever known. So I guess it's when the Civil War happens that spiritualism really gets burnished as something big.
Yes. So after this moment when the Fox sisters really take hold in the late 1840s, they're traveling all around the country, and skeptics everywhere want to disprove them. And
right,
so large public events are held to show that all of these spiritualists, and by this time it's not just the Fox sisters, but thousands of copycats, each with their own unique way of communicating with the dead. And every one of them is challenged. There's a great convention of spiritualist performers who arrive in Boston, and the Harvard faculty challenges them that they will show how, they will show how they are fooling their audiences. And those debunkers are very successful at this point. But then when the Civil War comes, all of that debunking just stops mattering as much as it did, because their need is so great that even this hokey parlor trick presents the possibility of hope, of solace, of communicating with all those lost sons and husbands and fathers.
So you mentioned Mumler and his wife, Hannah's, their business takes off. This becomes really popular. Talk a little bit about the images that they were taking, the photographs that they were doing. I mean, I think people may have seen these. There are all kinds of them now. Mumler did a lot of these. And, like, how did it work?
The Mumler studio was just like any other conventional photography studio. You would make your appointment. You would go into a well-appointed room, in a room bathed with natural light, and you would pose before the camera. And it was as if you were just going to have your image taken. And Mumler would always say that he could not claim, and he would not promise, that you would get anything other than your own picture. But when he developed these images, very often they would have behind the posed client a ghostly image, perhaps a hand or an arm reaching down or a full figure seeming to embrace the person sitting for their photograph. And many of the people whose photographs were taken by Mumler at this point claimed that they recognized these faces and figures who were appearing as ghosts in these photographs. And Mumler would always say that he did not know how this happened. He had no power over the spirit world, But for some reason, they just liked his camera. They liked to be in the presence of Mumler doing his work. And it was Hannah Mumler, and she is Hannah Mumler by this point. They have married and become life partners as well as business partners. And she is the one who is able to see the spirits in the studio and know when they are there. Mumler, again, maintains his innocence. He has no idea if the spirits are there or not at this point.
I wonder, what do you make, Peter Mansell, of the fact that when people would see these images, they are seeing children sometimes, family members? What do you make of that? Just this, again, there's this collective sense of grief. There's this longing for someone who's passed, and we seem to project they seem to project faces onto these images that they were seeing in some way.
They do, and I should say that some of the images are very clear faces.
Yeah.
Others are more amorphous. It's sort of like recognizing shapes in clouds for some of the images.
Right.
But some of them are very distinct. They just look like a photograph of a living person who you happen to be able to see through. But what we know about the reactions to these images, we mainly know through the people who believed in them. Those who sat for Mumler's camera may have been predisposed to believe in them. They were mostly spiritualists. And they generally were people who were there with grief as a motivation. They were there hoping to see the faces they ultimately saw. And all we can really know about their experience of seeing those faces are what they said about them, which was along the lines of, my boy has been dead for years, and here he is again, back to see his mother. Along those lines of, I have been desperate to see this face, and here it is before me. And we cannot interrogate them from this distance of history. We cannot say, but is that really your son? Or is it simply the image of a young boy who, in your grief, in your hope, was close enough? We can't know that.
Yeah.
We do know that many people recognize the images that they saw.
So people are fascinated by it, as business does well, but also there are skeptics, of course, always, and people trying to investigate what was going on and, the question of whether this is legitimate. And eventually he leaves Boston, takes up in New York in 1868, and it's not long after that that he's arrested. And the story about all of that, I think, is really quite interesting. Tell the story of Joseph. Is it Joseph Tooker? I guess it is.
It is. It is. So yes, Mumler comes to leave Boston, and the interesting thing about his deciding to take his business elsewhere is that it was really the spiritualist community of Boston that chased him out.
Yeah.
Boston at this time was the capital of spiritualist America, and the spiritualists of Boston were willing to believe that spirit photography might be possible, but they did not believe that Mumler was doing it. Something just didn't smell right about the images he was creating. And so Mumler endures a small scandal in Boston where those who would be most likely to buy his pictures come to distrust him.
Yeah.
And so he sees it would be advantageous to find another place in which to sell his images. So he goes to New York, which, while Boston was the capital of spiritualist America, New York was certainly the capital of photography in America. There were hundreds of photographers working on Broadway alone, and Mumler is able to secure a space within a Broadway photography studio. So he begins, just as he had in Boston, selling his spirit photographs. He goes to the local meeting of the Professional Photography Association and explains to them that he has developed this new technique of photography, that one day they too might be able to take pictures of spirits, and he'd be happy to teach them how for a fee, he explains.
Wow.
And he becomes more popular even than he had been in Boston. People flock to his door to have these spirit photographs taken. But along the way, the mayor of New York at the time, gets wind of this. Someone who was not happy with the photographs Mumler has taken goes and writes a complaint in New York City's official complaint book, which is the way you got the city to notice things at the time. You'd go into City Hall and you'd write your complaint in the complaint book. And Joseph Tooker was the marshal of the city of New York. And it fell to him, based on these complaints, to investigate William Mumler, to go to the photography studio himself and to demand to have a spirit photograph taken.
Now, when he does, he has one taken. He's undercover. Mumler doesn't know that this is the city marshal. And then I guess the reason for which Mumler's arrested is that Tooker doesn't recognize the spirit. Is that how it worked?
Well, when Tooker comes into the studio, he suggests that a spirit he might like to see is his father-in-law.
Yeah.
Mumler proceeds to take his picture, and when Tooker returns to the studio the next day, sure enough, he's given an image, and Mumler tries to persuade him that, in fact, the ghost present in this image with Marshall Tooker is his father-in-law.
Right.
But Tooker is unpersuaded that it is his father-in-law, and so at that point, he arrests William Mumler for fraud.
Yeah. Now, the trial, which you work through in great detail, it's a terrific part of the story. The stakes of the trial we have to talk about. I've heard it described as not unlike the Scopes trial in some ways, that you have this battle between science and the supernatural. Do you think the stakes were like that in some way?
They certainly were. And they were in part because there was a crusading prosecutor named Eldridge Gerry who saw in this case a case with which he could make a name for himself as a rising lawyer in New York City, and also a case in which the terms of what is acceptable in American religion were being laid out. Was spiritualism a belief that was worthy of being protected, or was it always just a scam? Mm-hmm. Was it always just someone trying to pull something over on the gullible? And this becomes a central question in the trial, which transcends the matter of whether or not William Mumler was selling what he claims to sell,
right,
and becomes concerned most of all with this question of belief and how one can reconcile belief with what others consider to be just common sense.
Right. P.T. Barnum is an important part of this story. And we should point out that he's no spiritualist. I mean, he, of course, is a great skeptic. He'd been following the rise of spiritualism pretty closely. But the role that he plays, his testimony, is really interesting. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about this, because what he says was, in essence, is he had been seen as a huckster himself, said he was giving people what they wanted. It wasn't his job to prove something, only to show the audience this thing and let them make up their own mind. You write in the book, Barnum had a clear sense of when a moral line had been crossed. So would you just talk about this part of this story, because it's really, really interesting.
So Barnum had been following Mumler's career since he first became known in Boston. Barnum had actually sent away and purchased by mail some Mumler images that he wanted to display in his American Museum in New York City. So he had several of Mumler's spirit photographs on display in a section of the museum that he called the humbugs of the world.
Right.
And so he was presenting them as clear frauds and as remarkable pieces of the humbugger's craft, I guess you could call it. And so Barnum is called into this trial years later as an expert on humbugs, as an expert on exactly the type of fraudulent scheme that Mumler is being accused of. But Barnum saw himself as a different class of person. He saw himself as an entertainer, as someone who was giving someone for a fair price, as he saw it, mm-hmm. an experience of transcending the usual understandings of the world, a way to engage with mystery within his American museum. And he saw spiritualists as something else. He saw them as taking advantage of the suffering of the gullible. And for him, that was going too far. So he explained that it's fine to want to sell such things to the public because the public liked to buy them, but to represent them as something other than they were was going too far for him.
it seems like Barnum's testimony was instrumental in helping William Mumler in his case.
Well, he was an interesting choice to bring in as the star witness. And by this point, he was the appropriate choice because the trial was full on a circus. It went on for months in the city court known as the Tombs in New York City. Mm-hmm. It was filled to the rafters with spiritualists and other odd characters day after day. The newspapers reported on it extensively. And so Barnum's presence was entirely appropriate in that way, but he certainly did not end up helping the prosecution's cause.
I don't want to give too much away, and I'm not sure how much you want to talk about what happens here. The judge, interestingly, is torn. He's skeptical on one hand. He knows there's something going on here in these Mumler photographs, but the prosecution isn't really proving the case.
And crucially, the prosecution could not prove that Mumler was not taking photographs of ghosts, in part because no one could prove that photography was not capable of doing so.
Yeah.
Because again, this moment of new technology had so radically changed the rules and the expectations of perception that everything that had seemed impossible suddenly seemed possible. And this is not just about photography. This is a moment in American history when the telegraph, for example, suddenly you can send messages across hundreds of miles, across the distance that no one could travel. And it was imagined that with just a little bit more power, you would be able to send messages even to the great beyond. Mm. The popularity or the rising use of electricity, the understanding that there are invisible forces all around us, not just in the animal magnetism sense that Mumler mentioned, but in a very real and practical sense. All of this is radically transforming the way that Americans are seeing the world. And this is all the context in which Mumler's trial takes place, that with so much new and so much that is baffling to people just on the street and in the courtroom, who is to say, this was the defense's case, who is to say that Mumler was not doing what he claimed to do, that ghosts cannot be seen by photographs? And so that uncertainty, this moment of not knowing or not being able to be fully certain what was real and what was not, all of this worked towards Mumler's advantage in the trial.
Has anyone figured out today how Mumler did it?
There are certainly photographers today who believe they know and believe they have developed a system that is something like what he would have done. But importantly, at the time, no expert photographer was able to determine how he had done it. And they followed him through his entire process. The prosecution's case brought in also a parade of expert photographers who presented ideas, procedures that they would have used to create the types of images Mumler was selling to the public. But then they had to say, when I watched Mumler work, I didn't see him do any of these things. Mm. So at the time, no one was able to determine how he had done what he had done.
There's a really interesting coda to this story. Mumler takes a photograph of Mary Todd Lincoln in 1872. This is, of course, after the president had been assassinated. And it becomes, you say, the most famous spirit photograph of all. And maybe you could describe this photograph and what we make of that image. Because on one hand, it's proof that Mary Todd Lincoln is just really gullible or really crazy. But on the other hand, it's also something more profound, that this is an expression of her grief and maybe by extension the collective grief of the country. And so it's a really powerful photo in some ways.
This is the last photograph taken of Mary Todd Lincoln in her life. She arrived at the Mumler studio by then back in Boston, dressed in mourning. According to the story the Mumlers later told, arrived under an assumed name, did not want to be recognized. And they in fact did not recognize her as she presented herself, but Hannah Mumler claimed to recognize the spirit of Abraham Lincoln, which entered the studio with her. So in the photograph the Mumlers took of Mary Todd Lincoln, she is there in the center of the frame, as she would be in any portrait photographer's work. But the outline, the very clear and recognizable outline of Abraham Lincoln, is standing behind her, seeming to cradle her from behind, consoling her, perhaps. And indeed, Mary Todd Lincoln by this point had suffered great trauma in her life. Beginning with the death of her son while they still lived in the White House, she was an ardent spiritualist, sought out mediums and held seances in hopes of communicating with her son, first of all, and then later, after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, with her husband as well. And so clearly came to the Mumler studio looking for this, looking for solace. And the Mumlers were able to provide just that. She believed in this picture wholeheartedly. She showed it to her friends and said it was proof that Abraham Lincoln was always there with her. And it's true that this image is a portrait of a woman in her grief, some would say in the grip of insanity. But it's also this portrait of the nation itself, forever haunted by the loss of the Civil War, captured in this one image. But to her, all of that was secondary. To her, she simply believed in the image, and that was enough, and that was enough for her to be grateful to Mumler for the rest of her life.
Peter Manceau, he's curator of American religious history at the Smithsonian. His book is The Apparitionists, a tale of phantoms, fraud, photography, and the man who captured Lincoln's ghost. He joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.